Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose courage in waging tirelessly battle after battle after battle in that war is our first guest. He is the representative of the people of the 1st Congressional District of Texas. He is Congressman Louis Gohmert, the chairman of the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, a member of the Judiciary Committee, where he is the vice chair of its Subcommittee on Terrorism and Homeland Security, and a member of really basically all of the best organizations on Capitol Hill and a leader for all of us there. Congressman Louis Gohmert, it is so good to have you back, sir. It's been too long. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Well, thank you, Frank. Always a treat.
Well, I wanted to talk to you first and foremost, sir, about a informal hearing about something that one of my friends is now calling no longer the House IT scandal, but the House Spy T scandal. I wonder what you could tell us about your experience last week as you looked into this question of what these Pakistani nationals have been doing with and to the House of Representatives, specifically members of the Democratic Caucus, and information on their IT systems.
It's just, as you know, virtually surrealistic how deeply embedded Imran Awan, who was not even a U.S. citizen when he first started working for members of Congress, handling their computer systems, you know, their IT systems, how he got embedded 12 years ago with top Democrats within the House of Representatives. We do have a system, and I think it's a good way, you know, to be able to do it so you don't have a member of Congress doesn't have to spend a fortune on having a sharp computer guy or IT person helping with the computer system and server in each congressional office. You can have one work part-time. You don't need them full-time, but that allows you to pay them a part-time salary. But nobody that works on Capitol Hill is allowed to be paid more than around $160,000, and that is top. Well, what Imran Awan did, he starts working for one and gets a partial salary, and then another and gets a partial salary. And when he hit $160,000, as Luke Rosiak, who's done more investigating than anybody that I'm aware of in this whole matter, it started with the Capitol Police investigating, and the only way the FBI could get involved, which goes outside the legislative branch, because of concerns about violating House privilege, they did ultimately get the FBI involved. But as Luke has said, 80% of the people, the witnesses that he has talked to, have never been talked to by the FBI or any law enforcement. And of course, you know, there are rumors out there that the FBI is telling the top folks at the FBI, there's nothing here, there's nothing here. Well, they hadn't investigated thoroughly. But Awan, so he would, once he hit the maximum $160,000, then he adds his wife, and then he adds another family member and a brother, and most of them never came to Capitol Hill to work.
Congressman, you're a serious guy. You've worked on issues involving criminal activity, terrorism, and so on, as a judge, among other things. I'd ask you, is there reason to believe that among the crimes that was committed here was espionage on behalf of perhaps Pakistan?
We have not had an actual House hearing and brought in witnesses, subpoenaed them if necessary. As chairman of the Tax Enough Already Caucus, is have a group meeting and invite witnesses and have them tell members of Congress what's going on. And one thing is clear, there are potentially hundreds of crimes. But as far as the spy ring, that's going to take law enforcement to dig down. But when you have a guy like Imran Awan, he brings in family members. Yeah, we heard evidence that a witness is talking about the vouchers that were submitted to buy, for example, $800 iPads. Well, under House rules, if something costs less than $500, it doesn't have to be part of the inventory. So Imran, he has submitted countless numbers of vouchers that had items he was wanting purchased for more than $500, but he would list them for costing under $500 and then say add a service plan that picked up the rest of it to get to $800. Well, under the law, every single one of those documents he submitted is a crime.
Yeah. Can I just do a thought experiment with you, Congressman? I salute you for this informal hearing, but I am struck by the fact, as I know you are vexed by it, that your leadership, the Republican leadership, has not wanted evidently to conduct a proper investigation in public, in the committees, at the very least. I'm wondering if the roles were reversed. Let's just say, for example, that Nancy Pelosi were Speaker of the House. And we tumbled upon, a ring of white supremacists who were providing tech support, IT support to dozens and dozens and dozens of Republican members of Congress. Is it conceivable that Nancy Pelosi would not be drawing and quartering every one of those members in public?
They would be having regular hearings. She would then have press conferences weekly, at least, to update everybody on just how deep the crimes are and how deep the complicity of the Republican Party. You know, you brought up potentially fine. The reason that people who have financial problems do not get security clearances like supposedly Imran has is because you are a potential target for blackmail, for extortion. We also, it came out that his little group has been loaned $100,000 by a guy with known ties to Hezbollah. We also know that what triggered Capitol Police concern was when Congressman Becerra, who's now Attorney General of California, no indications that Becerra did anything wrong whatsoever, but what got their concerns was they saw there had been potentially 6,400 unlawful accesses to his computer system. And then come to find out that actually Imran downloaded members of Congress's server systems from either iCloud or from their own servers. He said, he had a 2 terabyte server just so he could download his child's second grade homework. Yeah, well, that's absurd. But what has happened by him downloading all these different, so many different members of Congress's emails, calendars, all their computer system into his server, then anyone he wants to can get access to that information without having to get clearance from that member of Congress. And then we also find out that he had access to virtually all of the Democratic National Committee's information because we saw from WikiLeaks email, they were trying to get into one of Debbie Wasserman Schultz's or her iPad, and the email was sent saying, look, Imran Awan has all of her passwords, everything.
Congressman Perry said yesterday he thought that it was at least as likely, and frankly, more evidence, that was the source of the information, not Russian hacking, that created this whole, witch hunt, Donald Trump with Rob Mueller and elsewhere.
Yeah, we've seen indication that there is no way anyone, Russian or otherwise, could download the amount of information that was downloaded in the time it was downloaded through the internet. It had to be an inside job with a thumb drive, hard drive, something to download it more quickly.
Congressman Louie Gohmert, we appreciate tremendously your diligence in looking into this, calling attention to it, and hopefully creating conditions under which there will be more investigative hearings, either of the formal kind, preferably, or the informal kind that you've done so well last week. Thank you, sir, for your leadership on these and so many other issues. Next up, Ben Weingarten on the Iran deal, Trump and Congress and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Benjamin Weingarten. He is one of the rising stars, as far as I'm concerned, in the intellectual firmament of young conservatives, and a man who I've come to know and admire greatly for his work at ChangeUp Media, LLC. He is its founder and CEO. He's also been a Publius Fellow at the highly regarded Claremont Institute. You can find his writings in all the right places. They are helpfully consolidated at benweingarten.com. Check it out. Meanwhile, we're delighted to check him out. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you back.
Frank, thanks for that introduction, and it's always a pleasure.
Good. Well, let's talk about some of the things that you've been mulling, as have we. Specifically, I'd like to pick up on some of your analysis and current thinking of where we are with respect to Iran. The president, of course, last week said he's not going to continue certifying that the deal is either being complied with by the Iranians, that is the Obama bomb deal, or in our national security interests. And yet, as John Bolton Rood in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, he remains in the deal, hoping to somehow fix it. Tell us your thoughts about, is it fixable? And if not, what should we be doing?
Ultimately, I don't believe that the Iran deal is fixable because I don't believe that Iran is a viable, serious, credible, committed partner. I think that any deal that's consummated with this Iranian regime ultimately isn't worth the paper that it was printed on. And so when it comes to legislation that was put forth regarding the deal, which, as we all know, was not put up to the Senate as a treaty, it's kind of interesting. In some ways, what we're dealing with in terms of the decertification process and going to Congress for sanctions, while many conservatives are lauding the fact that we are incorporating Congress in the process when it comes to foreign policy and national security, the process itself regarding Iran deal, in my view, was illegitimate in the first place. So I think in some ways we're boxing ourselves into the confines of a deal consummated with a partner that isn't credible in a framework that is not commensurate with what we're dealing with, which should have been a treaty. And it should have been a treaty that would have been struck down. And of course, that's why the Obama administration did an end run around Congress and subverted it.
What is going to happen now? Do you anticipate Congress in this flawed sort of deliberative structure, if you will, is going to do anything? Snap back sanctions, for example?
Well, it seems that we've committed to the process of involving Congress. And of course, there's legislation that's, I think, been hammered out over, you know, the last several weeks and is going to go through a whole lobbying process regarding essentially, as you noted, snapping back sanctions. This is, of course, the cotton corker legislation that's been discussed. And look, I understand the impetus behind the notion of fix it or nix it, which is sort of what Benjamin Netanyahu has spoken to and various other allies of the U.S., and it seems like that's the framework that we're in, as opposed to just scrapping the deal. I think ultimately, though, this will probably prove a futile exercise, even if obviously it's great that we designated the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, as we did. And even if we do impose much harsher sanctions and essentially reimpose at least some portion of the regime, the sanctions regime that we had before, that's all well and good. But there's this kind of false notion that, you know, it's either we have the deal or we have war that the Iran deal echo chamber has been discussing. And the crucial point to understand is that Iran has continued to be at war with us since 1979. It isn't as if all of a sudden we had this pause and it was kumbaya in the world. Iran is now simply a richer, more legitimized regime in which it's going to be much harder to snap back sanctions because you have all of these parties involved that are profiting from Iran deal. And that isn't to say that ultimately if the U.S. said you either trade with us or you're locked out of basically, you know, all of your commercial relations, that the full faith and credit of the U.S. would not dominate in that scenario. But if the other parties don't deem us serious about the way in which we're going to engage on this, we do have a challenge ahead of us. And, you know, that's why I wrote about recently in The Federalist this article about essentially the fact that the EU, various ministers there, have been frantically trying to protect the deal, and they themselves have admitted that it's about economics, i.e. there are billions of dollars worth of trade hinging on sanctions not being reimposed. And so all of these parties involved are fighting tooth and nail to trade with and thus ultimately subsidize and strengthen this Shia 12er regime that is antithetical to all of the interests of Western civilization.
I think your headline on the piece was Iran deal supporters are willing to sell out the U.S. to jihadists. That's, in fact, only part of the point you're making. They're really willing to sell themselves out. It's just suicide, as I see it. Hey, Ben, let me switch gears quickly. Speaking of suicide, there is now coming out of North Korea a rhetorical flourish that exceeds even some of the past vitriol and threats that regime under successive Kims has expressed, to the point where the North Koreans are now saying nuclear war can happen at any time. I'm wondering whether you're struck, as am I, by what seems to be a rather remarkable discounting of all of this by some of our leaders, at least, and certainly most of the public. Is that advisable, or should we be taking this threat much more seriously than we are? And if so, what should we be doing?
Well, first of all, I think it's fascinating when you juxtapose the hysteria in the media, first of all, after about 70 years of Russophilia, that all of the sudden, $150,000 worth of Facebook ads allowed Russia, following the Cold War, to somehow subvert our democracy and steal the White House. So you have hysteria around what is a just on its face completely laughable narrative. And then on the other hand, comparatively with North Korea, no one takes North Korea seriously. But North Korea is a nuclear-armed rogue regime. And I think that their words and actions, their, you know, their bellicose nature, and the way in which they completely shrug off, at least rhetorically, the U.S. and the West, indicates that they feel they don't bear any costs for their words and actions. And that speaks to their belief that we don't pose, we being the West, a credible threat to them, or we do pose a credible threat, but we don't have the will to follow through on it. And so I think the challenge for policymakers is to figure out what are the proper actions to take commensurate with the nature of the threat. And one of the things that I know you've supported for decades, and I think all Americans should get behind, and frankly, it's stunning sometimes that we don't talk about it or think about it, is A, taking all the measures that we need to take to harden our own grid against the potential for an electromagnetic pulse attack, but B, deploying rapidly a much more advanced missile defense system that deals with the launch of weapons at all phases, including in the boost phase, because the notion of trying to hit a nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missile as it's coming down towards the surface, we're not 100% in terms of our hit rate. And so you need to have a multi-layered missile defense system that is really credible if we want to be secured against threats like North Korea, like Iran, and like others in the world.
Amen. Ben Weingarten, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as the great work you do. Check it out, folks, at benweingarten.com. Come back to us again very soon, if you would, Ben. Next up, we'll talk with Joseph Humeyer about what Iran is doing in our, well, front yard here in the Western Hemisphere. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a great pleasure to say we are joined by Joseph Humeyer. He is among those who has most rigorously and helpfully assessed what is going on in our hemisphere in the way of national security challenges and opportunities. He does that in his day job as the executive director of the Center for a Secure, Free Society. He's also served in theater as well as in this hemisphere with the United States Marine Corps as an 8-year veteran, including combat tours in Iraq and Liberia. He is doing great work, not least through the publication of important works, including his book, Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America. Joseph Humeyer, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be on.
Hey, before we talk about Iran, I want to talk about one of Iran's clients, shall we say, the regime in Venezuela of Nicolas Maduro. We've had an election there over the weekend. It's been widely described as unbelievably fraudulent and produced results lopsidedly in favor of the regime. Tell us what you make of what happened there and what is likely to befall the Venezuelan people next as a result.
Yeah, I think, well, you described it accurately. It was a fraudulent election, but that really comes as no surprise. Anybody that's been paying attention to Venezuela really over the last several years knows that they hold the facade of elections, much like Cuba and North Korea and Iran even. They work the outcomes well beforehand, and they just present the outcomes on election night. So what happened Sunday, it was a gubernatorial election. It was basically mayors and governors of different provinces all throughout the region, all throughout the country. And what's interesting to me is the way that they selected the specific Chavista-leaning candidates is in a way that they support the segmentation of their military, the transition of their military. So it's basically, it's almost like a political strategy to support a military plan. And this is something that's been going on in Venezuela for at least the last 2 years. The Venezuelan military has restructured itself to look less like a traditional military with, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and looks more like regimental combat teams that are divided to control specific territories in the country. Now it looks like the governors, a lot of them with former military experience, are now controlling the political levers in those parts of the country as well.
So more of the same, it sounds like, which means more privation, more hardship for the people of Venezuela, and more opportunities for penetration and subversion from Venezuela by governments like that of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We've been talking in the course of the program about what these guys in Tehran are up to with their nuclear deal and in the Middle East. But tell us your latest findings. I understand you've got an important conference coming up about a month from now. Would you talk about what you're finding, Joseph, in terms of the Iranian operations in and from countries like our Venezuela in our hemisphere?
Yeah, so in about a month, well, like you said, in exactly a month, in November 16th in 2017, we are going to hold a conference here in Washington called the Western Hemisphere Security Forum. So it's going to cover a range of topics, but, you know, given our unique focus, given my unique focus on ties between Latin America and the Middle East, we're going to use this conference also as an opportunity to release a study that we've been working on over the last year about the ties between Venezuela and Syria. And what this paper is going to focus on, and, you know, and subsequently some of the conversations during the conference will focus on, is on a very longstanding and historical bridge that's being built between Venezuela and Syria, a bridge that extends beyond just diplomatic and economic relations, that really goes into familial clans, structures, clandestine networks, and fundamentally two governments, the Assad government in Syria and the Maduro Chavista government in Venezuela, that's been snap-linked to one another so that what happens in one part of the world directly affects the other part, and they can use the two as proxies for fundamentally who's destabilizing Syria, which is Iran and Russia. Iran and Russia, as they're destabilizing Syria, are also destabilizing Venezuela, and both countries are used as proxy elements to delegitimize the United States. So we're going to be talking about that at the conference, and we're going to release a paper at the conference that really focuses on that bridge.
This is fascinating and very troubling. In my commentary today, Joseph Humeyer, I spoke about this General Qasem Soleimani, who, as you know, runs the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and is an agent of extraordinary, aggressive, violent behavior in all over the world, I guess now it's fair to say, including, of course, in Latin America. When you look at a guy like Soleimani, it's my recollection that he was implicated, as were the IRGC, which have now been, happily, finally, designated as a terrorist organization by President Trump, that he was actually plotting to engage in violent attacks inside the United States itself, notably in a restaurant in Washington, D.C., for the purposes of killing the Saudi ambassador. Have I got that right? And if so, what do you make of the fact that this base of operations in our region could be building for our security here at home?
Yeah, you are correct. You know, I don't know if Soleimani himself was implicated, but definitely the Quds Force was implicated in preparing an assassination plot against the Saudi ambassador here in Washington. They were using actually one of the proxies in Texas, and who was trying to get access to Mexican cartel networks, and they unraveled the operation, and they came to a real wire transfer of $100,000 that came from a Quds Force operative in Iran. So that was a real indictment, a real case, a real plot. I think what that case and essentially illuminated for everybody is that the Quds Force is already here. The Quds Force is in the Western Hemisphere. Most notably, they're in Latin America. They're in Venezuela. They have a tremendous infrastructure in Venezuela, and they've been there for a long time. And we have to understand, what's the Quds Force responsibility? What do they do? Well, you know, in a broad sense, they export the revolution. But how do they do that? They do it using unconventional warfare. They are the fundamental primary trainer of trainers. You could call them almost like the Green Berets of Iran, that go out and train surrogate states and surrogate nations. And so when you go to a country like Venezuela and you look at the police forces and you look at the security forces, the military, and you start to see some of their brutal, harsh, authoritarian tactics, you wonder where they learned that from. And it's very likely and probable that they learn a lot of that from Iran, particularly from the Quds Force, who trained these individuals both in Latin America and in Venezuela.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the IRGC and the Quds Force, one of the other offshoots of that sort of foreign legion, if you will, for the Iranian mullahs is, of course, Hezbollah. And Joseph Humeyer, you've been writing and warning for some time now about their presence in our own country as well as elsewhere in Latin America. Can you give us just a quick update on their status and the danger that they represent?
I'm glad you brought that up, Frank, because actually I want to call the attention to your listeners a very important case and I guess an important date that's going to come up very soon. On October 27th, a Lebanese individual in Peru who was arrested and accused and unfortunately not convicted of terrorism in that country may potentially be released from Peru. His case was actually appealed and brought to the Supreme Court of Peru. And the Supreme Court now has to rule it, put it on the docket to be able to rule it and try it again, because they decided that the non-guilty verdict of this Hezbollah operative's actions in Peru were warranted another look at, another review. However, if by October 27th, the Supreme Court in Peru does not put it on the docket, he's going to be a free man, and he probably most likely going to escape the country and be back in Lebanon. This case is, well, it's just one operative and one case. It's very important because it symbolizes what Hezbollah to me is far above and beyond most other terrorist groups, which is their ability to conduct reconnaissance and intelligence. And that's what he was. He was an intelligence reconnaissance operative. He came well advanced of a terrorist attack and plot 2 years in advance in reality. And he cased targets. He cased the country. He made the contacts. And to catch one of those individuals is almost like a gold mine. I mean, you know, those are very hard to catch. The very few intelligence operatives from Hezbollah ever get caught. And in the case of Peru, they actually got one. But unfortunately, the judicial system did not convict him.
Well, I hope we might get our hands on him at some point. But it really speaks to the point that they are here as well as elsewhere in our hemisphere. Joseph Humeyer, we have to leave it at that. I hope we'll have a chance to talk with you well before your important event at the Center for a Secure Free Society on the 16th of November here in Washington, D.C. We look forward to the fruits of it in any event, and thank you so much for the work you do. Keep it up, my friend. Kevin Freeman joins us next. We'll be talking with him about the reserve currency of the world and what it means for you and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by our friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, one of our senior fellows, Kevin Freeman. He is our duty expert on economic warfare, a subject that he addresses regularly and with great effect at globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is also the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin Freeman is soon to be the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. We are very much looking forward to its appearance and contributions to the public policy debate about economic warfare and more. Kevin, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
I wanted to ask you a question that addresses a topic we visit about with some regularity because I think you're doing really incredibly important path-breaking work about it. Namely, the efforts by Communist China, among others, but notably Communist China, to displace the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world. I was struck by a piece that one Dr. Michael Ivanovich wrote at CNBC's website the other day that sort of poo-poos this whole idea, while acknowledging that there's evidence that it's afoot. That the Chinese economy is well served by the greenback, so why would they de-dollarize? Give us your thoughts on this thesis that, well, it may be happening, but it doesn't make any sense.
Well, it was an interesting article, and he makes some solid points about how China might economically be better suited to just leave the dollar system in place, and that's certainly true in the short run. It would be highly dislocative for them to move away from the dollar. He chalks up any move away from the dollar, well, that's just politics. And this is where I would disagree with him. It's not politics, it's warfare. It was written in the book Unrestricted Warfare by the People's Liberation Army, PLA colonels. It's very solid. They've been moving this direction. And 4 or 5 years ago, they laughed and said, oh, China would never do that. Now what they're saying is, well, China's doing that, but it doesn't make any sense to us. They're missing the larger point. China has a longer time horizon than we have, and this is a matter of warfare. It's not a matter of simple economics.
It's not just the timeline. It's the fact that they earnestly hope to displace not just the dollar, but the United States itself, as I see it, as returning what they believe is the world to its rightful order of the Chinese as the center of the universe, Kevin Freeman. So to the extent that he's kind of missing that strategic purpose, I guess it's more understandable that he could be missing the practical implications of this beyond the very narrow short-term interests, as you say.
That's right. He does make a solid point, though, and that point is that we can prevent the dollar from being replaced. There's some solid things we can do as a nation. We're not doing them. Hopefully, we will be doing them. But the first of those is to recognize we're in an economic war. The second is that we shore up our economy. We have such arrogance that we can continue to perpetuate debt into eternity and realize that the world will not put up with that much American debt. And all the things that people lump together, and well, that's the Trump agenda. That Trump agenda is actually very good for the economy and very good for our economic place in the world.
And specifically good for protecting the reserve currency of the world, the dollar, which has, as you've described so often with us, Kevin Freeman, such incredibly far-reaching implications, should it be undone for not only the economy of the United States, but arguably for its, as you say, its strategic standing in the world. Kevin, one of the other folks who is sort of acknowledging you, or at least your long-held view, though seemingly dismissing its significance, has come up on the net in the New York Times to discuss how the North Koreans are emerging as a cyber power, something that seemed laughably ridiculous not too long ago. Talk a bit about what's actually happening and what it means that insights that you've had for so long are now being borne out by harsh reality.
The New York Times acknowledged the best security experts in the world now realize that North Korea is a full-fledged cyber power. They used to laugh when the thought was that they hacked Sony Pictures, but it was later proven that that was the case. They laughed when there was an $81 million theft from the international banking system that was tied to North Korea, but that's proven to be the case. And now they're acknowledging that there are digital sleeper cells that have been placed in South Korea by the North Koreans in the IT shops, which is something we've long talked about, infiltrating the supply chains. And so North Korea is a full-fledged cyber power. They're using that to attack the power grids, and they're trying to find ways to destabilize our power grid. North Korea is a genuine threat, and they are using every means of power at their disposal, including cyber, nuclear, and missile technology, and they are a serious threat, and we need to address it.
Yeah, amen to that. Kevin Freeman, of course, is our guest. He is the author, among other things, of an incredibly important book, Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. And Kevin, you said something last week that has been dogging me, and I just wanted to drill down on it a little bit further, that the North Koreans, further evidence of their prowess in the cyber domain, have apparently been hacking and mining, as you put it, Bitcoin. I'm struck by this fact at the same moment that the Russians have unveiled their design for a crypto ruble, their own competitor to Bitcoin. Where does this leave us, Kevin, that the North Koreans are able to get inside the wiring of these things, as well as the obvious push in Moscow and elsewhere for more diversification of these currencies?
Well, it ties into the first thing we talked about. If you want to displace the dollar, what do you replace it with? A cryptocurrency is an extraordinarily disruptive technology. It's the kind of thing that will change everything. You go from horse and buggy to automobile to airplane. And the Chinese, the Russians, North Korea, they've all recognized this, and they're all staking out their area in it so that they're not left behind. We're the nation that has the least addressing or adopting of this technology. It's happening in the natural market, but at the nation state level, we don't know quite what to do with it yet. The Russia was there 6 months ago, maybe even 6 weeks ago, but they've decided they have to adopt and embrace at least elements of this technology at the national level. North Korea, same thing. China, same thing.
And is there reason to be concerned that all of these will be subject to this kind of penetration that you described last week by the North Koreans?
Well, yes, there's reason to be concerned. If we've talked about quantum computing at some point, that could break encryption of any currencies. We've talked about electromagnetic pulse and how it could wipe out the power grid. So you have a cryptocurrency, it could be wiped out. The fact that they're getting in front of all of this, though, suggests that they're adopting it at the nation state level. We need to be addressing and looking at it. Our vulnerability is that we're first unaware and unprepared for it. Second vulnerability, that they're looking for ways that they could undermine Bitcoin, they're mining it and so forth, North Korea. So it's a very intensive topic, and it's one that we're going to have to deal with going forward in great measure.
We appreciate the chance to visit with you each week about these sorts of issues and look forward again, as I said, to Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, folks, check out his terrific work at globaleconomicwarfare.com. We'll talk with you next week. We'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.